Welcome to installment 91 of Sefer Mitzvahs from the Rambam. Today's portion contains three commandments. Prohibition 352, the prohibition against homosexual relations with one's uncle. 347, the prohibition of adultery. And prohibition 346, the prohibition not to have relations with a woman who is in nida. The first commandment of today's portion is prohibition 352, and it relates to a specific type of homosexual relations. In yesterday's portion, we learned that there is a general prohibition against homosexual relations, and there is a separate prohibition in the Torah not to have homosexual relations with one's father. A person that would do so would be violating two prohibitions, the general prohibition and the specific one relating to a father. So too in today's portion, someone that has committed a homosexual relations with an uncle is violating two prohibitions. The general prohibition against homosexuality, prohibition 350 from yesterday's portion, and prohibition 352, not to have homosexual relationships with an uncle. As the Rambam quotes from the Talmud Sanhedrin, that if one should do so unintentionally, then he would have to bring two chatos, two sin offerings, since there were two prohibitions which were committed. In this mitzvah, which in the order of the Rambam Sefer Mitzvahs concludes the section of incest and sexual crimes, the Rambam goes through a general summary of various punishments and sacrifices associated with these prohibitions, as well as many of the laws relating to capital crimes in general. First, the Rambam describes when someone would actually be put to death for one of these crimes. As he has used previously the expression niskaima ha'edus, when there is substantiated testimony. This means, says the Rambam, that there must be at least two witnesses who warned the person about to do the prohibition, warned him that he was going, that they are going to testify against him, and that he is prohibited upon pain of death against doing this act. So too, the law must be decided by a Jewish court of 23 members, and also applies only during the time when the Jewish court was capable of deciding regarding capital cases. This is only at the time that the temple was in existence, and when the great Jewish court, the Sanhedrin Gedela, Beis Din HaGadol, was situated there, and so on. From which place do we learn the various penalties for these various acts? The penalty of kares, or a cutting off of the soul, is written in the Torah explicitly regarding all sexual crimes, as in the book of Leviticus, chapter 18, verse 29, says explicitly that anyone that does any of these abominations shall be cut off, explicitly indicating kares for any of these violations. So too, the penalty of death, which is applied by the Jewish court, also is said explicitly in the Torah. However, the type of death penalty, the way in which it is inflicted, such as through stoning, through strangulation, or through burning, some of them are written explicitly in the Torah, and sometimes they are derived through the oral tradition. The details of all of these laws are described in the Tractate Sanhedrin and Krisus, as well as many places in Yevamos, Ksuvos, and Kedushin. As we mentioned in this mitzvah, the Rambam then goes through all different sorts of capital crimes, as explained in the beginning of Tractate Krisus. Any violation which, if done intentionally, would merit the punishment of kares, if done unintentionally, obligates the violator to bring a sin offering, a chatos. In general, this means a chatos kvua, a sin offering with a fixed price, a female lamb or a female goat. And if you investigate, says the Rambam, all violations which are punishable by kares, you will find that always, you will that when there is a chatas mentioned, a sin offering, it means this chatas kvua, a sin offering of fixed amount, with two exceptions. One exception is a person that is impure, who entered the temple grounds, who is chayav kares, and another one, a person who was impure, who ate meat of the sacrifices. His soul is also cut off, is punishable by kores if done intentionally. And if they do so unintentionally, again they must bring a sin offering, but a different type of sin offering, not the one of fixed price, but an eila v'yedet, adjustable according to the person's income. There is another exception, says the Rambam, of a violation which, if done intentionally, would be punishable by kores, the cutting off of the soul. But if done unintentionally, there is no sacrifice whatsoever, not any type of sin offering. And this is a person, a magadev, who curses Hashem. And a person that does so unintentionally does not have to bring a sacrifice, which, as explained in the commentaries, is because there is no action involved, and the sin offering is brought only when a prohibited action has been done, and his act of speech is not sufficient to be called an action. This is always the case, whether there's kores or chatos, when the person is certain that he has done the violation. Let's say a person should be in doubt whether or not he has done the violation, such as eating forbidden fats, which is prohibited by punishment of kores, and one ate something but was not sure whether it was forbidden fat or not. In such a case, there is another sacrifice a person must bring, an asham tolui, a guilt offering, which is based on an uncertain violation, as we will discuss later in the laws of the sacrifices. Now that the Rambam explained the relationship between the sin offerings and the punishment of kores, he explains the relationship between the punishment of kores and the death penalty, which is actually inflicted by the Jewish court. For every violation which the Torah indicates there is the death penalty, a person would get kares also if they did not actually carry out the death penalty, or if the court did not become aware of this violation. Should the person be put to death, then the eternal punishment of kares, of cutting off of the soul, is lifted. But if the death penalty was not inflicted, then the punishment of kares remains. There are 10 exceptions to this rule, where the penalty is death if the person is convicted, but there is no kores if this is not carried out. The first of these 10 is a Macy's, one who has incited a group of people to worship idols, a Medea, who has incited an individual to worship idols, a false prophet, one that has prophesied in the name of an idol, an elder who has rebelled against the decision of the Sanhedrin, a rebellious son, a kidnapper, a murderer, one that strikes his father or mother, and one that curses his father or mother. All 10, as we mentioned, are violations punishable by death, but not by kares. The second commandment of today's portion is Prohibition 347, the prohibition against adultery. The Rambam directly addresses the question about whether the prohibition against adultery is considered to be one mitzvah or many mitzvahs. As the Talmud in Sanhedrin implies, and as the Rambam explained at length in his 7 of the introductory principles, although different punishments are applied for different types of adultery, nevertheless they are considered to be one mitzvah. In general, the punishment for adultery is chenek, or strangulation, applied both to the man and the woman. Should the woman be the daughter of a Kohen, however, she is judged more severely, and she is punishable by sreifa, or burning, although the man who is involved still gets the regular punishment of chenek, strangulation. Should the woman be a naira murosa, she has been betrothed in the marriage ceremony of Kedushin, but the marriage has not yet been consummated, and before this happens, she commits adultery with someone, then both parties are punishable by skila or stoning. And although there are separate punishments and separate verses in the Torah for these different categories, nevertheless, they are still considered to be parts of one general mitzvah, as the Rambam explained there in his 7th principle. The Rambam quotes the Mechilta and the Sifra, both of which explain various verses relating to this prohibition. In Leviticus chapter 20, verse 10, there is a verse stating that both parties to an adulterous relationship are put to death. The Mechilt and Sifra point out, however, that this is only the punishment. And we know as a general principle there is one verse giving us the prohibition and another giving us the punishment. Where do we see that it is prohibited? This is Leisinaf, the verse given in the Ten Commandments. There is another verse, however, speaking of this prohibition, which the Rambam actually quotes at the beginning of Sefer HaMitzvahs from today's portion. In the Chumash, this verse immediately follows all the other verses which describe the various sexual prohibitions which we have been discussing over the past few days. However, it is expressed in a little different way. It refers specifically to the man, and it states, "Lisitin shchavta chalazara," literally, "do not give your seed in lying with her." And the Rambam tells us that the Mechilta and Sifra do not use this verse, since it refers only to the man and does not specifically address itself to the woman. However, as in all other cases of incestual and prohibited relationships, both the man and the woman are prohibited from such a relationship. Why then is the verse repeated? As in general, the explanation is evidently that it comes to add stress to the severity of the prohibition. In this particular expression used to prohibit adultery, we see an amazing thing. In general, the prohibitions which we've described previously are expressed in the Torah, lo sagala ervoso, literally do not reveal her nakedness, meaning sexual relations. Suddenly, when it comes to this verse, this prohibition, it has changed. It doesn't say, lo sagala ervasa. Literally, it says, do not give your seed to her, to lie with her. It has been pointed out, as far back as the Marachel Lev Harab Tzirufun, who was confronted with the question of artificial insemination. And the question was, would one be allowed to take the seed from another man in order to impregnate the woman? And the question is this considered an adulterous relationship or not? And Rav Tzirufun pointed out that although we cannot look at verses and decide the law directly based on that, we first must look in Talmudic sources in the Oral Torah. After doing so and concluding that it was prohibited, he points out that we see an amazing thing here in the Chumash. Suddenly, when it comes to adulterous relations, it says, do not give your seed. Not only do not have relations, but literally, do not give your seed. An amazing, amazing prophetic vision we see clearly how the Torah takes into account all future instances and indicates clearly that such an act is forbidden. Even in the case where one would be using seed from one's own husband, nevertheless, a Rav should be consulted since certain problems can arise. The final commandment of today's portion is Prohibition 346, a prohibition against having relations with a Nida. This prohibition applies to a woman when she is in her menstrual period, which the Torah tells us normally is a 7-day period, and so too, afterwards, as long as she has not immersed herself in a mikveh, she is in this status of a Nida, and both her and the man are prohibited from having relations at that time. Today, women may not immerse in the mikveh, not only after their menstrual cycle has been completed, but they must wait 7 clean days after that, as we'll explain, God willing, later on in the laws of Nida and Zava. It is a very unfortunate misconception that many Jewish women think that the concept of Nida has something to do with dirt or uncleanliness. This has two negative implications. First of all, that as a woman, she is somehow dirty by birth, since this is a natural body process. And another negative indication is that a mikveh is not necessary. All one needs to do is clean oneself in a place such as in a bath. And it was actually the case, has been reported, after observant Jews came to this country, unfortunately many of them gave up the laws of Taras Mishpacha, of family purity, in favor of additional cleanliness, cleaning themselves once a month or something of the sort. This idea is, of course, a gross misrepresentation. All the laws of Tumah and Tahara are chukim, things completely beyond our comprehension and have nothing to do with physical cleanliness whatsoever. Furthermore, they not only apply also to men, in a way they apply even more so to men. Any time a man would emit seed, for example, he is considered tamei by the Torah, and before being allowed to go into the temple, he would also have to immerse in a mikveh. As archaeologists who have excavated the city of Jerusalem have pointed out, that in many areas, almost every house had a mikveh. Certainly, they weren't for the women only. The women needed only approximately once a month. It was the men who were in constant need of the mikveh, as a result of the various forms of impurity indicated in the Torah. Even through going to a kosher, a valid mikveh, should one hair even of the man or woman be sticking out of the water, the purification would be ineffective. Clearly, we can see that this is not based on reason. There are nevertheless many effects of the mitzvah, which are obvious to all. Our sages tell us that as a result of careful observance of the laws of family purity, a pure soul is brought down to the child. So too, the cycle of abstinence and then reuniting has an extremely positive effect on shalom bayis, a good husband-wife relationship, and has been held responsible for the low rate of divorce among observant families. So too, there is abundant medical evidence indicating the low rate of cancer among women who observe the laws of family purity. And it is perhaps for these reasons that we see in recent times that even families who are very far from observing mitzvahs, and perhaps observe only one mitzvah, this is many times the mitzvah they observe, since the positive effects are so evident. Great effort should certainly be exerted in order to encourage its observance. Thank you for tuning in to the daily portion of Sefer HaMitzvahs. For more information or to sponsor a shiur, contact Sichus in English at 718-778-5436, and please join us again tomorrow.